May we completely realize the sacrifice to me.
Good morning. I'd like to welcome you all. I'm glad that the Ordinary Mind Zendo group could come into this incredible room. Thank you for coming. The theme of our sit this weekend is the Xinxin Ming, the poem, The Mind of Absolute Trust. And the San Francisco Zen Center chants a very short version of it, which we have in our chant books. So let's chant this together.
I made a mistake. You have your own that, and now we're giving away our sutra books. So could you give us back our sutra books? Now we have it. New to us, too. Thank you.
And since this is a poem, it's not exactly a chant. So let's more say it than chant it, but not say it like we're having cocktail hour conversation. So there's one place that people get confused about where the break is. And for me, I love it without punctuation because it, you know, plays with your mind a little bit, but everyone misses the fifth line down. If you want to realize the truth, don't be for or against. The struggle between good and evil is the primal disease of the mind. So let's say this together. The great way isn't difficult for those who are unattached to their preferences. Let go of longing and aversion, and everything will be perfectly clear. When you cling to a hair's breadth of distinction, heaven and earth are set apart. If you want to realize the truth, don't be for or against. The struggle between good and evil is the primal disease of the mind. Not grasping the deeper meaning, you just trouble your mind's serenity. As vast as infinite space, it is perfect and lacks nothing. But because you select and reject, you can't perceive its true nature. Don't get entangled in the world. Don't lose yourself in emptiness. Be at peace in the oneness of things, and all errors will disappear by themselves. If you don't live the Tao, you fall into assertion or denial. Asserting that the world is real, you are blind to its deeper reality. Denying that the world is real, you are blind to the selflessness of all things. The more you think about these matters, the farther you are from the truth. Step aside from all thinking, and there is nowhere you can't go. Returning to the root, you find the meaning. Chasing appearances, you lose their source. At the moment of profound insight, you transcend both appearance and emptiness. Don't keep searching for the truth. Just let go of your opinions. For the mind in harmony with the Tao, all selfishness disappears. With not even a trace of self-doubt, you can trust the universe completely. All at once you are free, with nothing left to hold on to. All is empty, brilliant, perfect in its own being. In the world of things as they are, there is no self, no non-self. If you want to describe its essence, the best you can say is not to. In this not to, nothing is separate, and nothing in the world is excluded. The enlightened of all times and places have entered into this truth. In it there is no gain or loss. One instant is 10,000 years. There is no here, no there. Infinity is right before your eyes. The tiny is as large as the vast. When objective boundaries have vanished, the vast is as small as the tiny. When you don't have external limits, being is an aspect of non-being. Non-being is no different from being. Until you understand this truth, you won't see anything clearly. One is all. For in it there is no yesterday, no today, no tomorrow. So that's a hard act to follow. This poem was, it's the first Zen poem in Chinese, and it expresses, as you can tell, the essence of Zen practice in very simple, beautiful form. It's attributed to the third Chinese ancestor, Zheng Chong, or Kanchi Sosan, as we chant his name in the San Francisco Zen Center. He died in 606 CE, and he was a layman over 40 years old when he began practicing, when he met his teacher, Wiko, in 551. I always found that quite comforting, a layman over 40 years old when he started. He had leprosy also. And he is, legend has it that he passed away standing under a tree in Gassho. So practice hard. Xin Xin Ming is the title in Chinese, but the two Xin Xins are not the same. Just how we pronounce them is the same. The character is not the same at all. The first character is standing upright. And the second character is heart-mind, shin, heart-mind. The Chinese don't distinguish like we do between psychological and emotional. So heart-mind is the whole thing, the whole thing. All one network. And Ming is verse. So this is a verse about the heart-mind standing upright. In English, we say the mind of absolute trust. Trust is preferred to faith because faith implies faith in. And we're not talking about that. Faith in immediately assumes something and you, some other and you. And the mind of absolute trust is not about trusting other or even dividing up into other. Well, in places it is, because it has the whole scope. So we're talking about trusting mind, an attitude of trust, an attitude of faith. So this is a wonderful koan to practice with. What? Where is that in me? Where is absolute trust in me? And if I can't find it, what is it that I don't trust? What prevents me from trusting? This is a very important point, this emphasis on trust as opposed to trust in or faith in. It's very important because it has huge implications for where we abide. Where we abide in each moment. Where is it that we stand and act from? Because we have faith in something. I have an IRA, therefore my actions will be clear and confident. Trusting mind. So the whole assumption of the poem is that we have come to practice in order to find a way to live with ease and generosity. So what does this mean to us, the mind of absolute trust? Where is this in us, in our actions? Where do we find it? What kind of mind is this? And why would we want to find it? We don't chant this or come to a weekend like this because we want something else to believe in. We already believe in too much. So this is not about believing in something. It's just faith or just trust. And according to Genpo Murzel, who wrote a commentary on this poem, the title means, and this is his language, the verbal expression of the fact that the very nature of experience and of all the phenomenal world are no other than the faith mind. The verbal expression of the fact, the poem is the verbal expression of the fact that the very nature of experience and of all the phenomenal world are no other than faith mind. But my own personal translation of the title is, we have no idea what's going on here. And if we did, we wouldn't like it. We couldn't stand it. So vulnerable and bewildered and heartbroken, we find comfort and ease in the free fall itself. Comfort and ease in the free fall itself. The scope of the poem, by the way, it's many times longer than this short version, about four or five times as long in these quatrains. And you can find it online, just punch in Xin Xin Ming, and you'll find lots of places to go for different versions. I personally like Richard Clark's version, but there are many versions, and you can just go on the web and find it. In fact, I've given Susan my favorite website for it. She can email it to you. I can't remember it. So the scope of this poem is all stages of practice. Basically, the poem describes the evolution of Zen practice from scattered mind to concentrated mind to one mind, empty mind, to no mind, although all these minds are actually not sequential. They don't hinder each other. They happen simultaneously. They're already within us. They're waiting for our embrace. They're waiting for us to cultivate the ability to notice them. They're already there, just waiting for our noticing. And why would we take the trouble to get still enough to notice? Because it's a lot of trouble, as you know. Just the packing alone is a lot of trouble to come here. So why would we do this? Because the alternative is to just be pulled around, thither and yon, to and fro, by our desires and our aversions, pushed here and there, smashed up against poles, ducking around corners to avoid people that we don't want to talk to, led around by our nose or our stomach or our eyes or more karmically complicated parts of our body. So we're dissatisfied, we're ill at ease, we're anxious. And as flotsam and jetsam in the ocean of life, we tend to identify with the waves instead of the ocean. Rising up, crashing down. Rising up, crashing down. So we believe everything that's going on in this movie, and we can't see the screen. So we desperately look for a way out of this carnage. And when I was talking earlier about where is it that we abide, that's what I'm talking about. You know, how do we deal with all this pain? Greed, hate, and delusion are our favorite refuges. And it's not that we should abandon them. It's incorporating something else into them, mindfulness into them. So the great way is not difficult for those who are unattached to their preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set apart. So preference begins with the emotional distinction between this and that. I'd rather have this. I don't want to have that. And most of the preferences we have are completely inconsequential. You know, what we're going to wear today, whether we want vanilla instead of chocolate ice cream, whether we name our child Humphrey or Bill. So most preferences are not that consequential, except karmically, if we fall into the rhythm and pattern of always acting on our preferences, then that builds up a habit, as you know. Same as biting your nails. So it builds up some way of being, which is, oh, I don't like this, oh, I like that, that sort of thing. And when we make the smallest distinction between things based on what we want or don't want, heaven and earth, they're set infinitely apart. We've all experienced this. And they can never be merged. Precisely because we don't see them as merged. It's not neutral territory for us. But in reality, our preferences are just relative to each other. We only understand pleasure in relation to pain. And we only understand pain in relation to pleasure. They are related. We only know earth because we can imagine a heaven. And heaven is usually what we want, and earth is usually what we've got. So if we live that way, it has tremendous consequences for how we perceive our lives and where we abide. So we're always landing somewhere on this continuum between heaven and earth and like and dislike. And if you abide in your preferences, that's what you'll do, is run back and forth on this continuum. It's endless. You'll always be pulled around. It will always have the potential to compromise your uprightness. It's very hard for us to be ethical. Why? Because sometimes the right thing to do is not in accord with our preferences. And it's very hard. If you ever get invested in things, you're capable of compromise. You're capable of compromise. We even get invested in not being invested. It's just endless. It's like a slug sticking to you. If you try to remove it, it's sticky still. There's no relief ever in the realm of preference. For instance, I have a student at home who got married recently, and she's having a very hard time adjusting to her husband. He doesn't do the dishes properly. When she touches the dishes, you all know this. You're married to a person just like this, or you're the person. You touch the dish and it's still greasy even though your partner has washed the dishes. So this was her problem. And also her husband farts in bed. So it's very hard for her to maintain that romantic idea. And he's also absent-minded. He's especially absent-minded when she's trying to control his behavior. Reminding him that he should do the dishes better. And that he should go to the bathroom to fart. She's tried with my aiding and abetting, with my complicity, that's what it is. She's tried various strategies. She's tried to change him. Actually, she did that on her own. I wouldn't have advised that. But she also tried accepting him. Just whatever he did, that's fine. She'll eat from the dishes. She'll hold her nose. But she's miserable. Miserable both ways. So if you don't ever begin to wonder or to question why you suffer, to question what aspects of your mind and body cause you so much anguish and pain, then you will just spend your life led around by your desires and pushed around by your fears and hatreds. And the really sad part of searching for happiness is that it's futile, because if you look for happiness outside yourself, what you find is outside yourself. You know, a new car or a new house or a new lover or new whatever, new self-help regime, new diet. So if you're looking outside, that's where you'll find it. It's outside. All stuff that can evaporate in a moment can be taken away from you. So you'll never satisfy these desires outside. They're endless. And more our culture is hooked into this. Our economy is certainly hooked into this. Studies show our children have low boredom threshold compared to past generations. They get so much and they tire of things more quickly than we did. Our culture trains people to crave something and then get tired of that and then crave something else. Our economy is based on it. In fact, when I speak to a large group like this, I feel a little concerned that the economy might suffer if we stop being such ardent consumers. I'm always torn this way. So this kind of search for happiness that we do is very foreign to stillness. There's a franticness about it, a jitteriness, an unable to settle kind of thing. Because if you prefer something else to this, it's very hard to settle into this. Buddha assumed that happiness is a natural state that results from the absence of alienation and clinging. That we're just naturally happy. It's kind of the anti-Freud view of man. That we're just naturally happy if we don't have these hindrances. And the point of Buddhism is to create a person whose happiness is not dependent on circumstances. Whose happiness is not dependent on the circumstances of his or her life. When we become able to watch our thoughts as they arise without preference, like we watch scenery from a car, then we can settle down into whatever our experience is. So after practicing a while, we stop rejecting some thoughts and cherishing others. It's just a natural process. We don't actually have to worry too much about it. This is the beauty of Zazen. We're training for it right there, sitting there, watching things arise, pass away. And we notice that we don't want some things to pass away. You know, fantasies about Brad Pitt are over all too soon. And then the next thing arises, and maybe we don't even want that, and that stays a little longer than we would have liked. But this is training. Zazen is training in this non-preference. You don't actually have to worry about it too much. Just do your Zazen. So, for instance, people hate to be confused and bewildered. I think people would actually rather be angry than confused and bewildered. There's such an emphasis on being decisive and strong in our culture. But there's actually nothing wrong with being confused or deluded. You'd be better off settling into delusion if you're deluded or confused. At least there wouldn't be a struggle. It's much easier not to fight the states of mind that you have, because then you add another layer, but just to settle into your fog. And if you find yourself struggling, hankering after clarity, then to settle into that unease. That unease. You know, I love reality shows, even though I've been told that they're very politically incorrect. Now, I don't have a TV, actually, but I see a TV a couple of times a week. I stay with students. And so I want to watch reality shows as soon as I'm there. And they have incredible reality shows. I mean, I could just go on and on, but I'll tell you why I like them. Because for me, I'm fascinated. They're like little contrived labs of suffering. You can see why. You can see how important the precepts are. You can see how important it is to get in touch with a part of yourself that is not overwhelmed by preference. You just see that. You just watch it. Every time I see a reality show, I am totally inspired for my practice, because if it weren't for the precepts, there I'd be, giving all my energy and intelligence to competing with other people for money and attention. That's just what I would do. In fact, it's bad enough the way it is. But I feel like practice has rescued me by giving me an alternative to living that way 24/7. Has given me an alternative by sopping up some of that overwhelming preference with a view of compassion, with possibilities of compassion and the practice of no preference. So I'm mostly rescued from the extremes of suffering that I see on TV, the extremes. So if you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. So how do we get freedom from our likes and dislikes? Well, Buddha was a refreshingly practical guy. In the Four Noble Truths, he sets forth the causes of our suffering, longing and clinging, and its cure, the Eightfold Path. And once that we understand deeply from our own experience, not somebody telling us or what we read, but from our own experience, that preference and craving is the cause of our suffering, then we're more open to look elsewhere for our activity, for some sort of way of acting. Then the only thing left for us to do is to be in the world in a less preferring way as it arises for us. We start thinking of being the ocean rather than the wave. But this is not anything against the wave. I personally believe you should rise up and crash down. Rise up and crash down. You don't want to get lost in emptiness. You should rise up and crash down, but not have a preference for being calm and serene. So the way is perfect, like vast, vast space where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. And more as we pay attention to the true nature of things, rather than the reality of our preferences, we notice that what things have in common is that they're equally empty, equally conditional. It's we humans that put values on things, that make them have different meanings, like a chair. A chair is made for humans. A cup is made for humans. We value these things because we're human. So we begin to think less about our preferences and more about the preciousness of each thing and each person as they manifest. And this is called suchness. When you read about suchness, this is what it is, appreciating each thing. It's totally unique, and it has in common with other things that it's conditional, conditioned on our values. But it's totally unique in the moment that it appears to us. I see this from a different angle than you do. So my student, the one who was disappointed in her marriage, she had to make a choice. She had to decide what was more important to her. Her husband's farting in bed, or the fact that he was sharing her bed. The suchness of him. The preciousness of him. The fact that he is her husband. So So what is most important to her? She finally had to make that choice. It makes it much easier to appreciate the suchness of things. So when we begin to be directed by this mind of absolute trust, it's actually quite thrilling. I'm sure that you've had this experience. You'll make up your mind about a certain situation that's coming up and what your behavior is going to be, and then something in you comes forth that you didn't even realize was going to happen. I can think of an example. When I was a body worker, a woman asked me in my sangha, asked me if I would work on her because her back was hurting her. So, but I was very dismayed by this because I never liked her. And I thought, how can I wish her well and my healing energy when I don't like her, you know? So I went and asked my teacher, you know. He said, don't worry about it, just give her the bodywork treatment. So I did. I arranged the table and everything, and I thought, well, I'll just make this short, and I'll make the emphasis on exercises rather than my touching her, because I'm sure she'll feel my dislike. She'll feel my antipathy. And that's very intimate, to touch someone with your hands. So she laid down, and I put my hands on her. And at that moment, there was no dislike of her, no antipathy. Everything just flowed. And I was able to give her the touch, to touch her with loving hands. Something else flowed out of me, something that had nothing to do with me, as far as I could see. I just touched her and wished her all the well-being that I could possibly wish anyone. And then the second very dramatic incident happened rather recently. I moved to a new town where an old friend of mine that I sat with at Green Gulch Farm for many years lived, a small town. And I immediately, put flyers up for a pain workshop. This is my profession. I work with people in chronic pain. So I put up flyers, made a workshop day. And so he immediately called me and he said, you know, I'm working in pain now, and this town isn't big enough for both of us. So I said, well, where I come from, San Francisco, you can't work long enough or hard enough to help all the people in pain. And he said, well, it's different here. I said, excuse me, but I'm not going to take my flyers down. And he said, let's meet and talk about this. So we met, and the situation deteriorated. So we couldn't figure out a meeting time after that. But so we decided on a phone call. And before the phone call, I made all my arguments in my mind. And, A, B, and C. And even, I thought, even as a last resort, I would criticize his practice. So I had all this in my mind. This guy, is standing in my way. So he calls, and here I am completely prepared to tell him why he's so wrong, and much to my astonishment, what came out of my mouth was, I will never abandon you. I will never abandon you. We will keep meeting and talking as long as we live, as long as we live in this same town. Because our bodies were just like this at Green Gulch for years. Now, we weren't friends particularly at Green Gulch, but our bodies were there. 7-day sessions, 3-month practice periods, they were there in the same zendo. And this is what came out of my mouth. And when he heard this, he said, "Let's meet Tuesday." And he came in to the cafe, and he had a long list of all the pain clinics in the area, their directors that he had contact with, and he said, "Please call these people. They will hook you up." So this is what arises out of us. Of course, I have plenty of instances where the results were terrible, but I'll just tell you this. I've vowed to the Sangha at San Francisco that I was going to give a whole lecture of failed practices, but I haven't said that to you yet. So live neither in the entanglement of outer things nor in inner feelings of emptiness. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. Nothing to separate us from just this. No idea or preference. So Buddhism has several metaphors for clinging. One of them is when you let go of clinging, it's unclasping the fist here. You know, you had this closed fist holding on to stuff, and then when you let go, the unclasping of the fist. What a relief. Then the image of pulling your hand out of the fire. That's a potent one. My little grandson, he seems to know that intuitively. I say, "Oh, I'm going to take you to a play. How would you like to go to a play about Peter Pan?" He says, "Grandma, I'd rather put my hand in a fire." And also the collapse of the giant tent because its main pole has been broken. The collapse of a giant tent because the pole holding it up, greed, has been broken. Letting go is the central theme of the Shinshin Ming. Don't keep searching for the truth. Just let go of your opinions. For the mind in harmony with the Tao, all selfishness disappears. Eventually, we have enough stability from our sitting to see that there's no place to go. There's no improvement to make. I really think the stability of sitting helps us face ourselves. We flinch away. "No, I couldn't be like that." And we come back. Flinch away. No, it couldn't be true. Come back. Come back. Develop the stability to look at yourself. See what you're like. So we have relief, actually, when we don't have any more preferences. A woman told me after a sitting like this, a short sitting, she said, "Oh, what a relief not to have to decide what kind of tea I'm going to drink." In our sashins were served tea. Or what I'm going to eat, or what I'm going to wear, or what I'm going to do. What a relief, she said, to just do things without making decisions. With not even a trace of self-doubt, you can trust the universe completely. All at once you are free, with nothing left to hold on to. All is empty, brilliant, perfect in its own being. In the world of things as they are, there's no self, no non-self. If you want to describe its essence, the best you can say is not to. So where in your mind, where in your thoughts is that? It's already there. It's already there. So you can't make sense of this poem without a Zazen practice. It's pretty much gibberish otherwise, But there is something deep within us that relates to it no matter what. Because one time I was spending a weekend here in New York through the Open Center. Some years ago I spent a weekend with a group of teenage boys in rehab. I came and, oh, there were tons of them. There were like almost 30. And I said, oh, how delightful that you all want to learn meditation. And they said, it's mandatory. So, what could I do? I had them chant the Shin Shin Ming. Well, after that, they were stunned in the silence. They were stunned by the Shin Shin Ming. They just were stunned into docility. And we continued with the class. You can't make sense of this. It puts you in conceptual free fall. And Zazen gives us the stability to accept as real, completely destabilizing experiences. Completely destabilizing, like looking at the world from your breast point of view. That's pretty destabilizing. Nothing stays where it is. I inhale and you guys start bobbing around, and I exhale and the room starts moving around. But it's from the breath point of view. When you realize this, what reason for holiness or wisdom? Completely extraneous. The mind of absolute trust is beyond all thought, all striving, is perfectly at peace, for in it there's no yesterday, no today, no tomorrow. So just sit. Look at everything over the next couple days from your breath's point of view. See all your thoughts and judgments as arising from some standard that you call your preference. And its causes and conditions, you probably don't even know or remember anymore what they are. And when we pass each other outside in the hall, or are aware of each other as we walk around the room in Kinin, let us just appreciate that intimacy. Thank you very much.